Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. In August of 1913, a self-taught artist named Joseph Knowles set out into the Maine woods. He was alone, and basically he was naked. And he set out with the intent to try to survive for 2 months using only what he could find in the forest. He sent back accounts of his activities written in charcoal on birch bark, and these were published in the newspaper in Boston, in a paper called the Boston Post. This was great for circulation. People loved this story. And when he came back, that is when Joseph Knowles came back, he was for a time a celebrity until a rival paper in Boston said that he was a fake. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll tell this story, the story of Joseph Knowles, and talk a little bit about what he did or didn't do, and why it was that this caught so many people's imagination at the time. And our guest for the program is Jim Motovalli, and he's written a book on this. The title of his book is Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. It's published by the DeCapo Press. Our guest is a journalist. He is the editor of E!, the environmental magazine. He's also contributed articles to the New York Times, Salon, Boston Globe, The Nation. He is the author of 4 books, makes his home in Connecticut, and he's talking with us by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. All we ask is that people just try to be brief in their questions so that we can keep the program moving along. But, of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening on the air, over the air, in Illinois and Indiana, or you might happen to be listening on the internet, you can use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Motovalli, hello.
It's great to be on.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I have to say that one of the great things for me about doing this program is that I am always getting the opportunity to learn new things and hear new stories and learn about stuff that I had never heard of before. And certainly, I would say this, Joseph Knowles in this story is completely new to me, and I was really glad to have the opportunity
to learn. You said he's completely nude to you?
Well, no, not quite, but one could go either way on that.
They could, couldn't you? I think your experience is very similar, because it's remarkable how this extremely colorful figure is basically lost to history. And when I heard the story, I certainly hadn't heard it before. Mm-hmm. And there's very little in print about Joseph Knowles, despite how famous he was back in 1913, and despite how he caught the public's imagination, as you said.
Well, here, just to talk a little bit about what, in brief, to talk about what he did, and we can talk about how this happened and how people reacted. But, in fact, here is a picture right early on in the book. Here's a photograph that apparently was published in the Boston Post, August 4th, 1913. Here he is in the woods about to set off, and he is surrounded by people who are there presumably to see him off. He's shaking hands with someone, and he is standing there. He apparently was wearing a jock strap. He had an athletic supporter on. But other than that, he was naked. He's barefoot, and here he is getting ready to turn around and set off into the woods, as I said, essentially naked and with nothing.
Right, and he discarded the jockstrap as soon as he was out of sight of that group there, because he really did want to go in with taking nothing with him. And he sent out these dispatches from his woods lair every day to the Boston Post, written, as you said, in charcoal on birch bark. And gradually, as they started appearing in the paper, the editors moved the story from the back of the newspaper to the front page, because the volume of letters and inquiries they got, people worried that Joe was going to like freeze to death out there, was such that they realized they really had an important story on their hands. And by the end of it, it was not front page story, not only in the Post, but in the other papers in Boston, because they realized how much public interest there was in it. The circulation of the Post doubled in the time that he was in the woods. And when he emerged from the woods after having been chased into Canada by Maine's game wardens because he didn't have a proper hunting license, he was wearing a bear skin from a bear that he had trapped and dispatched with a club. And that particular incident really wowed people. And people were amazed that he knew how to make fire by rubbing sticks together, even though this is a, you know, one would think was a fairly common skill at the time. And it had even been published in the fledgling edition of the Boy Scout Handbook, which had just appeared. But people were amazed by this. And as I do in the book, I trace how there was so much interest in what he did because of what time this was, because in 1913 the frontier had been reached. There was no more western boundary. You know, there was no more wild land to explore. And even though half of the American people still lived on farms, they were moving very rapidly from farms to industrial jobs in the cities. So it was a time of somewhat anxiety, I would say, on the part of the American people who were starting to adjust to this new urban life and not sure whether they liked it or not, and were worried that they would lose their connection to the land. That's why books like Call of the Wild and Tarzan of the Apes were such huge hits, I would say.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting here is that his experience, the fact that he did become well-known, what he said he did became well-known, and he became a celebrity, and the fact that other colorful characters, particularly people coming out of the West, became popular culture heroes, all of this would not have been happened if there not had also been mass media to help promote them and their stories.
Right, and I traced the sort of frontier myth and how it spread and how it was always based on fakery and myth and tall tale versions of the truth. If you look at the so-called dime novels that were often the way the frontier stories were spread, they bore very little relationship to anything true. And this has a big relationship to Knowles because he was charged with being a fraud by the rival paper, the Boston American, which was jealous of the circulation gains the Post had made. They said that he'd actually been lounging in this comfortable cabin and that his bearskin was full of bullet holes and that he'd bought it from a trapper and that his messages in charcoal on birch bark were actually written in pencil lead. All those kinds of things like that.
Well, you know, there were a lot of aspects of this story. I mean, really, if you think about it, man setting off naked into the woods, managing to survive by doing things like, as he said, trapping a bear in a pit and clubbing it or killing a deer with his bare hands, stuff like that. You'd have to at least wonder, now, doesn't that just stretch the bonds of credulity just the tiniest bit?
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, Knowles unquestionably had those skills. If you look at his past, he grew up in rural Maine. He had been a logger. He'd been a trapper. He'd been a hunting guide. He'd been in the Merchant Marine and in the Navy. He was covered with tattoos. He had a long and colorful past before he went into the woods. He may have been naked, but he was carrying that past with him. And he had been bragging in the bars of Boston about his ability to do this, and finally a newspaper man took him up on it. And it really was a very well-timed experiment in the woods. The paper very much portrayed it as a scientific experiment to show that modern man had the moxie of the caveman. And I think they were able to demonstrate that. But then when he was charged with being a fraud, that really did. For one thing, it kept it in the front page after it probably would have faded out. And the remarkable thing is that the paper that accused him of being a fraud later hired him to go into the woods again. They realized what a big box office attraction he was. And fraud or not, he sold papers.
Yeah.
So the Hearst chain, which owned the Boston American, sent him into the woods again in California and in the Adirondacks of New York.
It's almost hard to imagine just how much people gravitated to the story and grabbed onto it and followed it. And then when he came out of the woods in Canada wearing his bearskin and then came back to Boston, something like 200,000 people turned out to see this guy.
Right, which was a third of the population of Boston at that time. And there's a picture in the, if you don't believe he had crowds like that, you have only to look at the picture in the book, which shows the public just mobbing the streets. And there was probably 100,000 people in the streets, and then he met another 100,000 at events that day when he came out. He was given the keys to the city by the mayor and the governor, and just remarkably celebrated. He even went into the window of a big department store in Boston and changed from his bearskin to a suit of fine clothes as people watched. There was a banquet in his honor, and they scattered leaves on the floor so he'd feel more at home. And I should add that he almost did this in the Midwest. He had a scouting expedition, which was reported in the Kansas City Star, and looking around for an appropriate bit of woods for him to repeat his experiment somewhere in the Midwest, but he claimed to not have been able to find a suitable piece of land. I would imagine in 1913 you would have been able to come across some wilderness in the Midwest.
Probably so. It maybe at that time it would have been harder to find, but I'm sure he could have found some place to do this. He also wrote a book about his experiences.
Well, you have to put "wrote" in quotes. Well, it came out 2 months after he came out of the woods.
I guess the idea is that probably this reporter Michael McKeo that later said yes, he hatched this idea with him. Probably he was the guy who wrote "Alone in the Wilderness."
No, actually, it's a different guy.
Oh, it's a different guy. Oh, okay.
Another one of the reporters at the Post, who's thanked in the introduction to Knowles's book, is probably the author. McKeo could have written it too. McKeo might have done a better job, actually.
So there was a book. A book appeared, purported to be his account, and also this book sold very well.
Yeah, it was widely reported to have sold 300,000 copies. I think the actual total is probably like 20 or 30,000. But nevertheless, it did sell very well. And he did go on the lecture circuit, what was known as vaudeville at the time, and he would make fire on stage, and he toured the country doing this and was extremely successful. Some of the posters have him appearing with a dancing bear, which I'm sure that was a hit too.
Our guest on this part of Focus 580, Jim Motovalli. He's a journalist. He's editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, and he's the author of a book that tells this story, the story of Joseph Knowles. It's titled Naked in the Woods, and it's published by DeCapo. And the book is out now, and it's a good story. Questions, of course, are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here. I wanted to get on the conversation. We'll start with someone in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
When did this happen? What year?
1913.
Okay. I was out visiting a friend of mine in Immigrant Valley just north of Yellowstone, and he had a book that told about a fellow in the, I think it was the late 1870s or 1880s, who got lost, wandered away from a party in Yellowstone, got lost and survived for a month in Yellowstone, and then wrote about his experiences when he got out. I remember one special description where he's sleeping under a tree and hadn't eaten or drank anything for a long, long while, and there was a bird sitting on the ground, and he pounced on the bird and ate every bit of it. And do you know about this? And if you do, is that a fake too?
I don't know that particular story. That's interesting. I do, however, in the book, trace many similar stories, and Knowles himself inspired many people to go into the woods. And I also, some of them were total copycats who did exactly the same thing, but almost all the other expeditions came to grief. One thing or another, it snowed, or they got bitten by insects or something. They got sick. Almost nobody else completed
their time in the woods. Whether Knowles knew about this particular story, and
he might have
tried to copycat it. What's your last name again?
Motovalli.
Motavalli.
I ends in
I. Do you have an email address or something? What I can do? Let me write my send an email to my friend. And see if he can send the...
Well, maybe I could just give it to the host.
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
Okay,
do it that way. But
Sure.
I do in the book, I trace many strands of people who had done this kind of thing in the past. I mean, English estates used to have ornamental hermits on them.
Yeah.
And I talk about how in Germany there developed these Wandervogel and Naturmenschen movements of people who, you know, were sort of proto-hippies in a way, that they believed in going naked into the woods. And this was around the same time of Knowles. And whether he was influenced by that is probably it's hard to say. I think he probably was not, because being naked was not really part of it for him. It was just a means to show that he was taking nothing in with him. He wasn't a nudist in that sense.
Uh-huh.
I think he'd be shocked by the idea that he considered there to be some inherent benefit
to
being naked.
The
Naturmenschen in Germany, they were really into that.
There are some stories, of course, of feral children who got lost in the woods or wandered away.
Oh, yes, in India, raised by wolves. Yeah. That did indeed occur.
There was one case that I know about that occurred. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, we'll go next to someone in the nearby community of Belgium. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. In your guest few earlier comments, he was speaking about the Midwest and whether this guy wanted to do it in the Midwest. I wonder, and quite possibly, if he got his inspiration from the Midwest, because in the 1812, 15, right through there, where we are right now was part of the Northwest Territories. And the Northwest Territories, being what they were very wooded. And there were actually people who were called couleurs de bois, runners of the wood. And they literally were naked. They were usually part whatever Indian tribe was around and white. They usually were those sort of mixes. And they were quite adept at taking care of themselves in the woods and fairly naked. And they were quite famous for coming into town being quite a... When I say town, I have to say pretty much just small settlements, okay? And they lived in pretty much the Northwest Territory, the areas of northern Indiana, what's now Indiana, Illinois. And they really were naked people in the woods.
You know, since I wrote the book and I do radio talk shows like this, I have found all kinds of interesting threads that I didn't know about. And one of the other shows I was on recently, a caller told me that the Boy Scouts had published a book in 1919 that is about two Boy Scouts going naked into the woods. And I said, the Boy Scouts published this? And I looked it up. The book is actually online. It's called Boy Scouts in the Wilderness. It's plainly a copy following Knowles' thread. And it was published by the Boy Scouts of America. I'm not sure that it's even illustrated. And I'm not sure that, you know, they would do that today.
No.
But it's amazing to find it there. If you Google that, you can find the book online.
Well, I just wondered if this gentleman had really been informed of these. These were very early people, though. This was back before Illinois was anything like a state, before there was Ohio or Indiana or all that portion. And they were quite native people.
And what was that name in French that you used?
Well, I can't speak English very well, and my French is much worse, okay? It's couleurs de bois, the runners of the woods, and it's not... There are historical mentions of them throughout this part of the Illinois and Indiana and stuff. It was also called what was called the Limberlost, that also was kind of the area, east of the Wabash River, up towards Gary. There was a huge area there was wooded with pine trees and stuff, and it was part of the area that was last settled because it was wet and woody and things like that.
And well, you know, it's interesting about these Germans who were Naturmenschen and going naked into the woods. A lot of them emigrated to California, and when you think about it, it makes a whole lot of sense, because if you're going to be naked in the woods, you might as well be somewhere warm, right?
Yeah,
I would imagine Germany as similar climate to the Midwest, that, you know, in the summer you can probably do this, but once it gets to be September, October, it's really not, you know, being naked in the woods, you're going to just be standing there shivering.
Well, these people lived a much rougher life than we do. You have to realize this. They definitely were able to handle weather much better than we were, because they never knew the indoor of a house, you know what I mean?
Well, I have an anecdote in the book, or Knowles meets an Indian person, or he used to tell this story of asking an American Indian who was just wearing a loincloth why he wasn't cold. And I can't remember exactly his retort to that. He said, the Indian said, "Is your face cold?"
Yeah.
And Noel said, "No." And the Indian said, "Indian all face."
Yes. I've heard that same quote before. Well, thank you very
probably
much.
Probably not original.
We have, as our guest, Jim Motovalli. He's a journalist. He is editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. He's contributed articles to many different publications, New York Times, Salon, Boston Globe, The Nation, and he's the author of this recently published book, Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. It's published by DeCapo. Questions welcome, 333-945, toll free, 800-222-9455. You said, and here again it's an interesting part of the story, is that after Knowles came back to Boston and had this great reception, and he became a celebrity and was making at least a little bit of money on speaking engagements, and this had been all very good for the Boston Post newspaper that had published the stories, a rival paper that was really unhappy that they had this great story that was a Hearst paper, attacked him and the story, basically saying that the guy was a fake. One of the ironies, though, is that then later, as you explained, another Hearst paper, The Examiner in San Francisco, proposed that he do this again.
Exactly.
And this time the stories would be in The Examiner. So Knowles went out to the West, looked for a suitable place to do this, picked out an area that was, I think, kind of on the border between Oregon and Northern California, and set out again. Then there's another picture of him standing wearing a loincloth with a couple of guys as he's getting ready to head off and do this again.
Exactly. He went into the woods a second time, and, you know, he was charged with being a fraud the first time, and nobody charged him with this in his second trip into the woods on the California-Oregon border. And I think this is because his accounts are remarkably different than they were in Maine. He really communicated a sense of privation, of nearly starving to death in the woods. It's quite a bit more somber. And I think this is because it's a very honest account of what he actually experienced. He didn't know anybody in California, so I don't think he was able to have Confederates in the woods supplying him with food and shelter and all that. I think he very honestly did what he set out to do in California. And the irony is that it was interrupted by World War I breaking out. He was holding the front page until, you know, things went crazy in Europe, and suddenly war news took over the front page, and Knowles was very upset by this. He stayed in the woods until his assigned time, and he came out, you know, pretty scrawny and bedraggled, but he did indeed stay in the woods. And he did have a pretty good aftermath to that. He made Hollywood films. He appeared on stage with Ishii, the last wild Indian, in San Francisco, and they made fire on stage by rubbing sticks together. And he decided he liked the West Coast and pretty much stayed there after that, though he did have one more expedition in the woods. And I believe that William Randolph Hearst himself directly intervened to make the third one even more spectacular by having him go in the woods with a woman. And I think my research indicates that Hearst was probably personally involved in picking the woman on this expedition, and she was Elaine Hammerstein, who was the first cousin of Oscar Hammerstein III, the famous Broadway composer. And she was a silent film star of the era. She'd been on Broadway shows herself. She was quite an accomplished actress who eventually made like 50 silent films, but she was comically inept in the woods in the Adirondacks. When they finally went into the woods, she didn't realize she was supposed to kill things. And the idea of getting blood on her hands was just like really anathema to her. So after they went through all this training, after the New York Journal did endless shots of her wearing grass skirts and things like that, and really some very heavy breathing stories they published about how great she looked in her outfits, they then had to backtrack when she pulled out of the operation after like 2 days in the woods.
Yeah. I suppose that, you know, if you were intent on selling newspapers, the only thing that would be better than the modern Tarzan would be Adam and Eve.
Exactly.
As a kind of a story.
That was the analogy they used at the time, Adam and Eve in the woods. They'd originally planned to send a whole squad of women in with a woman leader, but somehow that plan got dropped in favor of just this one woman. And again, I think that William Randolph Hearst was personally involved in picking her, though you won't find this in any of Hearst's biographies. Maybe this is too prurient a story, but she'd actually appeared in one of Hearst's own serial films, which were being shot in nearby Ithaca, New York. And I think that Hearst probably saw her there and thought she was great for this forest maiden role.
Mm. The as we've mentioned, that there he had, when he came back from the first trip, the one that he did in Maine, to this great reception, this lasted for about, I think, a month, a little bit more than a month, before the Hearst paper there started to attack him. He said, no, I really did do what I said. And that's when he ended up going out west and doing it again. The later on, one of the things you write about in the book is that actually sometime later in the late 30s, this journalist Michael McKeough, who was a freelancer, came forward and said, or somehow the New Yorker, and it was published in the New Yorker, said, yeah, I met this guy in a bar and he was talking about he was a great woodsman and we got this great idea. Well, this would make a great story. And apparently it was McKeough who took the idea to the Post. And in this article, McKeough says, yes, basically it all was a hoax, that he really didn't do it. He wasn't really keen on that. We had to push him to go out and get a tan, so he actually looked like he'd been outside, and there was the whole business of the bearskin and everything, and essentially McKeough said, well, you know, we made it all up. Do you find that probably that is true? And at least as far as the first experience, the one that he had in Maine, that Knowles had in Maine, that probably what McKeough said, the story McKeough told, was actually the way that it really was.
Yeah, I think it probably happened something similar to that. The fact is, though, that story in the New Yorker, one thing I think it demonstrates, there was still a lot of interest in this, because this is more than 20 years later that they ran this piece in the New Yorker. But it's a rather odd piece in that it allows McKeough to tell his story, but doesn't let Knowles have his say, even though he was still alive at that time. He was living in Washington State. And he did respond to it. He wrote indignant responses to the local paper out there in Washington State, but I don't know that it really got him very far. He claimed to have been betrayed by McKeough and that it was all lies and everything like that. I think it probably did happen somewhat similar to what McKeough said. And, you know, it's a funny thing about Knowles. He definitely had the skill, but he was kind of a lazy guy. And in the main trip, he really could get away with not being bitten by insects and walking around naked, so I think he chose the easy route. But he had the skills. I think he really did it in California, and he would have done it in the Adirondacks. And on the later trips, they sent in these professors with him, these savants in the language of the day, these academics who specialized in this area, and they were following him pretty closely. So it would have been pretty hard to fake at that point.
Mm. Yeah, and as you say, when this story was published in the New Yorker in 1938, Knowles was in near 70, I think, and living in Washington State. And of course, he was incensed that he was being accused of being a fake, and said so. I guess another one of these aspects about the story that's a little bit surprising is why at that late date, 20 years later, anybody would care anymore.
Well, if you read the New Yorker story, it's very much played for comic effect. I mean, the whole thing has the makings of a Hollywood comedy, I think. It definitely has its comic aspects. You know, if you're making a film out of it, it probably wouldn't be the most serious drama in the world. But I think there's serious aspects to this story. But you could also play it for laughs and have a nice chuckle over the whole thing, because it's one of the biggest pieces of tomfoolery to come out of the early teens, I would say.
Well, and that gets, I suppose, back to the question of why it is people loved this story so much, and why it is that people were ready to grab onto it or anything like this. They were very receptive to this kind of story.
Yeah, definitely so. And, you know, there was, you think about the time, 1913, it was like a year after the Titanic went down. And maybe people had some anxiety about whether this modern civilization was really, going to work out well, whether losing their connection to nature was really a bad thing. And hence you had the huge success of Tarzan of the Apes, which was being serialized just that year. And according to, you know, there's many versions of how Knowles came to be in the woods. One version, which was in the Christian Science Monitor, written by a reporter who had actually worked at the Post at that time, said that the editors were sitting around and talking about how Tarzan was a big hit. And they came up with the idea of having their own Tarzan, really. And they said that, well, we got this guy Knowles who had actually worked for the Post as an artist, and he says he's this great nature man. Why don't we send him out? That's one version of how it might have happened. It could have happened that way.
Hmm.
I wasn't able to, you know, get to the total bottom of exactly how the trip into the woods happened, but there's a lot of intriguing evidence.
Did he actually have talent as an artist?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was a very good artist. And in fact, if anyone in the audience just goes on Google and does something like Joseph Knowles Art, and it's K-N-O-W-L-E-S, you will find some of his work on, you know, through eBay or Google. There's oil paintings of his that now go for $10,000 or more. And his copper engravings are, even the slightest of those is worth several hundred dollars. So he painted the official portraits of the governors of Oregon and Washington State. He did many public murals. He worked for the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, during the Depression, and really was very successful as an artist. One of the ironies is that he wasn't really satisfied with that. He fancied himself as the nature man, and he really wanted the public to embrace him through his own writing. And he did copious amounts of writing in his later years and was able to get very little of it published. And you can sort of see why, looking at his works. And there's a museum out in Ilwaukee, Washington, that has his papers. And his stories don't really hold together that well because he was such a... he was one of those people that would be great if you were, you know, in a bar with him. He tells stories really well, but he also digresses madly and can't stay on one subject for very long. And, you know, as literature, it doesn't work all that well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big pile of rejection slips he got, too. So he's probably rather frustrated that he couldn't find anyone else to sponsor another trip into the woods or to run his nature stories.
Yeah, and that identity that comes from this experience, that nature man thing, it sounds like that is something that he really held on to all the rest of his life.
Oh, very much so. And I found like some 1920s stories when he was already ensconced in the Washington seafront, where reporters came across him, and he really tried to convey the impression that he was still going into the woods naked any chance he got, where in reality he was kind of settled in and keeping his clothes on most of the time at that point.
Yeah, well, it would have been at that age, it probably would have been a little tough, a little tougher than it would have been when he was a younger man. And actually, he wasn't all that young when he did this the first time.
He was 43 when he went into the woods.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe because I'm sort of middle-aged myself, I can really identify with this, you know, arthritic old guy in the woods. And again, the book is called Naked in the Woods, and I have to say that I had so much fun writing it. I mean, I've written 5 books, and this one was the most fun to write, and I so much enjoyed the time I spent in Joe Knowles' company. I really felt I got to know him well.
Yeah. Well, readers can do the same by looking at the book. Let me mention the title again. It's Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. It's published by DeCapo. It's out now by our guest, Jim Motovalli. He's a journalist, and he's editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. And, of course, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're talking just at the beginning of the program. I said that, you know, for me, one of the great things about being able to do these kind of interviews is that I get to learn about things that I never heard of before. And you talked about the fact that, yeah, it's this man and his story is one that has largely been lost. And so for you, part of the appeal was just being able to recover it again, to tell that story again. How was it that you yourself heard of Joseph Knowles?
Well, if you pick up the book, I do tell this story in the introduction to it because I thought it was such a colorful story in itself. In 1999, I was asked by the Institute of Journalism and Natural Resources to go on a media trip throughout Maine, and we were just looking at interesting environmental issues there. You know, we visited sardine canneries, and we went out on lobster boats, and we looked at dams that were being removed, all kinds of interesting stuff. And our leader on that trip was a fellow by the name of Andrew Weegar, who was the most fascinating character. He was a nature man of his own, of a slightly different type. He was a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School and an ordained minister. He was a accomplished writer and short story writer. He built canoes. He restored houses. He was writing a history of the American eel. He was just the most colorful guy, and he told a story really, really well. And he was also a whitewater rafting guide, and he took us on a whitewater rafting trip on the Kennebec River in Maine. And as we were going down the river, he told us the story of Joseph Knowles and his trip into the woods of Maine, and it was so colorful. And right after that, you know, when he finished the story, we hit a rock, and I fell out of the boat into the Kennebec. So that may be why the story stayed with me. And unfortunately, I dedicated the book to Andrew Weegar, but he's no longer with us. He died in a really bizarre tractor accident, I believe it was in 2003. So he never got to see the book. I'm sure he would have written it himself if he'd had the time. He's one of those guys that had a million projects and didn't finish them. So I'm sure the Nature Man would have been one of his unfinished projects.
Yeah. Let's talk with somebody else here on line number one, Champaign County. We're here where we are. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm late for an appointment. I shouldn't be calling, but the point, you mentioned that he toured with Ishii, or at least was on a stage.
Yes.
With the whole dimension of the colonists' apprehension of the Native Americans seems like it would figure highly in this. There are a lot of dimensions to this. Getting in touch with your primitive concept is still, I mean, Boy Scouts still do this. I think in a summer camp in southern Illinois, they used to go out and be led out blindfolded in a loincloth and have to spend the night out in the woods or something. I think I did that, actually. Maybe.
Right, don't you think they've sort of lost that aspect?
I mean, well, I don't know what they're doing now. But
I think there could be some liability issues now.
But the point is that it seems like it's this misapprehension of Native American culture. I mean, there were some cultures that did sort of these vision journeys and things like that, but predominant culture, particularly in the East, was very, very complicated cultural edifice. So it seems to me that it's sort of idealizing this primitive, which only exists in the absence. And it seems like it's a cultural myth. I've just been sort of influenced by a couple of talks by Susan Faludi in talking about the cultural aftermath of the whole colonial experience.
Well, it's very interesting you should mention this, because in the book I have a whole chapter that's about the Native American threads here. And Knowles very much claimed to be influenced by the fact that he had Native American heritage on his father's side, and by the fact that he had supposedly at least spent something like 2 years living with Native American tribes in the Great Lakes area. I mean, it's kind of impossible to verify that he really did that, but he said this is where he had learned his wilderness skills. And when he came out of the woods, he did indeed visit with a bunch of Native American tribes, and they compared notes and things like that. And he did have his time with Ishii, the last wild Indian in California, after he came out of the woods on the California-Oregon border. They shared a stage in San Francisco. One of the ironies there is that Knowles was wearing his bearskin, and Ishii was wearing a suit. And Ishii succeeded in making fire on stage, and Knowles did not. And it's you know, there's sort of cultural things going on there, because Knowles had a sort of a condescending attitude towards Ishii. He assumed that he had greater intelligence, you know, inherently. He thought that Ishii had some native cunning, but the white man was inherently more intelligent. That was how he expressed it to people out there.
Yeah.
And there were also a number, in fact, there's a story on Slate magazine, if you go see it now. It's that basically the headline is, "Why do so many people pretend to be Indians?" And, you know, Knowles could have been one of those people, because he really sort of talked about himself as if, you know, he was practically a Native American himself. But just very recently, there was a scandal involving a book that was supposedly a memoir by a woman who claimed to be half black and half Native American about her growing up in the South Central L.A. area and living in gangs and stuff like that. And it was proved to be a complete fabrication. She has no Native American heritage. She was actually affluent and completely white. So that's just the latest person to pretend to be a Native American. But I also, in the book, trace the story of Gray Owl. And Gray Owl was this Canadian Indian who was sort of a proto-environmentalist who made speaking tours in the 20s and 30s. And he even appeared before the crowned heads of Europe, until it was revealed on his deathbed that he really was an Englishman by the name of Archie Bellany. And he had successfully passed himself off as Indian for something like 20 years. Now, Knowles didn't claim to be fully American Indian, but he definitely drew on those traditions. So I thought it was appropriate to go into that in the book. And certainly the Boy Scouts did that a whole lot, and the precursor of the Boy Scouts was the Indian Guides. And the whole thing was based on various parts of Native American lore. And as I mentioned, they had this book that came out in 1919 of going naked into the woods, and very clearly inspired by Knowles. And Knowles himself became a Boy Scout leader, and the Boy Scouts reprinted his own book, Alone in the Wilderness. So there was quite a Boy Scout Indian connection there.
Well, certainly at this time, it would have been true, and I don't know if there are people who still believe that, but I think at this time it would have been true that there are people who would argue that you know, that civilization has made men soft, and that what people needed to do was to toughen themselves and to get back in touch with nature, because it was a way of drawing strength, and it was bound up with real manliness and what that was supposed to be. And there was sort of this idea that you know, that nature was masculine and civilization was kind of feminine, and it weakened.
Exactly, this was a big strand that was happening at the time, and people like Teddy Roosevelt were weighing in on it. Very much the American boy was thought to have, you know, sort of lost his connection to the woods and get sort of effeminate. And what he really needed was some time spent in the woods. In his own book, Knowles has a whole chapter on this and how the American boy needs to, you know, reconnect to nature. And it was kind of sexist, because I didn't really say anything about the modern girl having an issue here. But he did attempt to, and he talked a lot about this, creating a sort of school of the woods where boys could be reintroduced to nature. And he did take Boy Scout groups into the woods naked, all that kind of stuff. But he never really established his school as he wanted to do, but it could have happened.
We've got a couple of minutes left. We'll try and get one more caller here. Line number one, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, just kind of commenting, some of the things that people have been saying recently reminded me of a story in my family where my grandmother, this would have been probably 20 in the 1920s, that she had a child that was sickly, and the cure was to take the whole family camping, and they went camping with this child all the time, and to try to get, you know, a healthier environment, I guess, for them. So I think it was, as you say, very much a part of the culture, trying to kind of maybe a reaction to industrialization or something.
Oh, very much so.
That, it was the medical treatment even of the day, kind
the
of
healing power of the
Teddy
woods.
Roosevelt.
We still believe in that today, don't we? We still think that the woods can have stories to teach us. And I would say today, the idea of the American boy and the American girl being alienated from nature is much more of an issue today than it was back then. When you think of the Game Boys and the TV and all the other electronic aids and the cell phones that kids have today, they spend a lot less time in the woods than the average kid of 1913, and scholars are talking about that.
Yeah, I know. I also did Girl Scouts with my daughter, and I felt really glad that I was the person who did it, because we went camping a lot, and for a lot of girls, that was the only time they ever were able to do that, and they loved it. So.
Right, and my girls are scouts also. My 13-year-old is still in scouts, but I do notice that they don't go out, they don't spend all that much of their time, and they do more like cake decorating than they do going out in the woods, I'd have to say.
Yeah, each troop has its little whatever you would call it.
Well, at least we still have scouting today.
I think that it's funny that we always kept all of our girls. We never had anybody drop out, and that was our specialty, because I think a lot of the girls were not able to do that anyplace else, and it's because their families weren't doing it either. So thanks a lot.
Right.
It was an interesting question.
All right, thank you. Well, it does make me think about, going back to this time, I'm sure that people would have had real concerns about urban life, that they would have thought of cities as being places that were dirty, were crowded, were polluted, and that somehow the idea of getting back into nature would be more healthy for people.
Yes, they definitely had that sense, and I think they were gratified by the apparent success of Joseph Knowles in the woods, because maybe it spoke to their own abilities there.
Mm-hmm. I'm still also going back to this thing about the appearances that he made in California with Ishii. I'm still intrigued by the idea that people would pay money to go into a theater to sit down and watch some guys rub two sticks together and make fire.
Well, Knowles was making $1,200 a week, a fortune at the time, to go on the vaudeville circuit and do exactly that. At the same time, people were paying similar money to hear a fellow who I also describe in the woods, Charles Kellogg, the nature singer, who would get up on stage and imitate bird calls. And he had a similar environmental message, and he traveled around in a truck that was made out of a hollowed-out redwood log. And he was enormously popular, too. Another forgotten nature figure from early history there.
So Knowles did indeed make, how much money would you say that he made off of this being naked in the woods thing?
Well, there's no sense that they actually paid him, that the Post actually paid him very much money. If they did, it was kind of under the table. It certainly didn't get, I couldn't find a contract or anything. And he made money probably mostly from his book and from his personal appearances on the vaudeville circuit. So he made a fair amount of money. And later, he made considerable amounts from selling his artwork, and he would get commissions of $5,000 or more in the height of the Depression. The problem was that he spent it as fast as he got it, and he was broke most of the time. But you have to say he was successful at doing what he did.
And you would say that the willingness of people to pay that kind of money for his work wasn't just the virtue of the work, it was also had to do with who he was, that he was the artist?
It had to do with who he was, but he was also, I would say, a very popular artist whose work was clearly inspired by Joseph Remington and other Western artists of the time. You can go out to Washington State and in the Monticello Hotel in Longview, Washington, there are 42 of his paintings that were done for the lobby of the hotel that are still there. And you can sort of get his sense of the winning of the West, the whole thing is called.
Mm-hmm. So when did he pass away?
1942. And there are still people out in Washington State that remember him, that were kids. And he was just great with children, even though he didn't have any of his own. He spent a lot of time telling tall tales to kids, and he told them about his boyhood experiences and about his friendship with Jack London, which may or may not have been true. I'm not sure. Again, he makes no appearance in Jack London's biographies, but he had many stories of time spent with Jack London, and London apparently picked the location of his going into the woods on the California-Oregon border.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we're just about at the point where we're going to have to stop. I guess what I come away with is that, you know, not only is this a great story that it tells you something about the time that it was written, but we still haven't completely gotten away from that. And there are still people who have this desire, have this urge. And, you know, it just makes me think about, for example, all of the interest in John Krakauer's book, Into the Wild.
Well, let me make an even more exact parallel. The so-called reality TV, you could say that Knowles was an early reality TV person before there was television. And life sort of imitates art. There's this popular program called Man vs. Wild, starring Bear Grylls, that's on the Discovery Channel.
Not familiar with this program.
No, he goes into the woods alone and challenges nature and everything, and he's been charged with almost exactly the same kind of fraud as Knowles, that instead of sleeping naked in the woods, he's actually going to comfortable bed and breakfast with internet access. And he was exposed by the Daily Mail in England. It's all online if you want to take a look at it, but if there's any exact, I mean, it couldn't be a more exact parallel to Knowles today.
More things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's a great story, and folks can read it in much more detail here than we've discussed if you want to take a look at the book. The title is Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. It's published by Tacapo by our guest Jim Motavalli, Motavalli. He's a journalist, and he is also editor of E, the environmental magazine. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Great. Thanks to be on.
Support for today's program is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign for over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of The Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will talk with Richard Longworth. He's a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's a former foreign correspondent with the Chicago Tribune. We'll talk with him this afternoon about his book, Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalization, How Globalization is Affecting the Midwest. That's our topic this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Chicago. In Chicago, I don't have the Kansas contract for you this afternoon or this morning here, late this morning. So we go to Chicago. March wheat, $12.95, up $1.55. July, $11.81 and three quarters, up $0.60. March corn, $5.66.5, up 11. May, $5.77.5, up 11 and three quarters. July, $5.89.5, up 11 and a quarter. December, $5.89, up 10. March beans, $14.11, up 23. May, $14.27, up 20 and a half. July, $14.42, up 21 and a half. November, $13.23, up 23. March meal, $3.53, even, down 20. Don't have an oil contract for you this morning either. Let's go to the Merck next in Chicago. April live cattle, 90.15, up 40. June, 91.75, up 25. March feeder cattle, 99.60, down 60. April, 102.40, down 72.5. April lean hogs, 58.45, up 72.5. Outside markets, April crude ticking away here, very active.